Just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Good morning. How you doing? Welcome to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm here to talk with you about the markets and the economy and some of the goings-on in those worlds this past week and how they might affect your investments. And before we get into the hard data, I just want to offer you a phrase that may be totally appropriate for what's going on right now. Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's partner, offered this one. He said, if you're not confused, you haven't been paying attention. So quit paying attention. In any case, what next week we've got the Fed board is meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. Doesn't look as if they'll do anything with the rates, but that's my opinion anyway. And then we'll also be getting the manufacturing report next week from the ISM, and also the jobs report next Friday, and we'll see how that's trending. And by the way, 40% of the S&P companies reported their earnings this past week. It's the biggest week for earnings. And 77% of them put up earnings better than what the analysts had expected. And yet we got the market we got this week. So I'm going to try and help you make sense of that. If not, take what Charlie said and quit paying attention. So let us do the dramatic reading. Where did the indices all end yesterday? The Dow was lower by 366 points at 32,417. S&P at 41.17. The Nasdaq was up a little bit, actually, at 12,643. Russell 2000 ended at 16.36. Gold settled at $1,999 an ounce. Silver at $22.86 an ounce. Crude still down, but it was up today or yesterday at $85.35 a barrel. 10-year Treasury was bid last at 4.83%, and soft white wheat quoted at $6.94 a bushel. Well, you know, before we get into market stuff, I'm going to go over the GDP. We'll be going talking about the market, of course, and then some of the economic reports came out. But I also want to talk about perspectives and attitudes in the marketplace, because I think as the financial pornographers at the financial media outlets are want to do, they create this angst and anxiety among folks that isn't really warranted. For instance, you may have read that or heard that the NASDAQ and I think it was the S&P, maybe the Dow, I don't know. One of them, or both of them, moved into correction phase yesterday. Now, what does that mean? That means it's down 10% from its previous high. So that suggests, though, that there must have been a bull market in there somewhere in order for it to have been down from a previous high. And again, for the record, there is a bull market that started in October of 2022, that is. And has been going. Now, you see these drops, these corrections. They are not unusual in a bull market. They can happen. Matter of fact, every year going back to, I think 1930, there has been an average drop in the S&P of 13%. So, again, this is usual and normal, but that's why you got to not get too involved with these headline-oriented clickbait kinds of stories these folks come up with, because they're not the whole story by a long shot. Sorry, but it just bugs me. Let me just hit on a couple of these stock prices that got all wacky this last week. Alphabet, I don't know why they changed their name. Because, anyhow, Google beat Wall Street expectations on both revenues and earnings when they reported, I think it was Wednesday. However, their shares fell the most since October of last year after their cloud unit didn't do as well as analysts expected. Now, isn't that, that's always irked me. Who are these guys? Who said they could be in charge? You know, I mean, who cares what they expected? Anyhow, that's the problem with, in my opinion, quarterly earnings. But this was in a big contrast to what Microsoft did. because they showed accelerating growth in its Azure Intelligent Cloud business. Their shares were up 4% Wednesday. But then come Thursday, the NASDAQ dropped, which is where Microsoft and Google and these other stocks hang out. It dropped Thursday because of Meta, a.k.a. Facebook. They didn't, the analysts didn't like, or the traders didn't like what they had put out for earnings. So Microsoft, which had been up 4% the day before, was now down 3%. Did the company change? No. It had. This is all about trading. This is, had nothing to do with fundamentals. And for which reason I always say, don't watch the news. Don't pay any attention to the day-to-day thing because it will make you nuts. Now, we know it's been a tough year for utilities in general. Yeah, and that's, again, part of the usual rotation of the markets. It's their turn to get beat up, I guess. They're off. The utility sector is off about 16% this year. They're up just a fraction so far in the month. But, you know, everybody who likes income likes utilities. That's kind of been a given over the years because they get, you know, pretty predictable dividend payments. They tend to be consistent, occasionally going up. But as interest rates have risen, relatively speaking, they have fallen on those hard times because the utility companies in general are they get forced into higher financing costs. And so what does that do to their balance sheet? And of course, you know, the presumptions are always negative. So that's why you have to sell the shares. I mean, if you're a trader, that is to say. So now there's nothing wrong with traders. Don't misunderstand me. They fill a very important part of our market. But traders are very short-term oriented folks in terms of how they go about their business. And so if you're trying to follow a trader, you better be one, because otherwise you're going to create a lot of fees and perhaps a lot of tax losses. Now, let me jump over to some of this economic news that's come out this week. If you didn't hear it, this was last week, but I'll repeat it. The Social Security cost of living adjustment for next year is going to be 3.2%. Yeah, don't spend it all at once. Okay. Now, good news perhaps for those of you who are natural gas users for your heating bills. They expect it to be lower this year because there's a oversupply of the product right now. Now, here's one I'll bet you're surprised about. The median net worth, the real median net worth, so that's adjusted for inflation, for U.S. households, that didn't say except for yours, they said everybody's households, was up 37% from 2019 through 2022. Now, that's a pretty dang big jump. You know, you think that 2022 was not a great year for diversified portfolios. And again, they're inflation adjusted. And while the net worth grew 37%, the other side of the barbell, the debt, total household debt, grew less than 4% from the same period. So I think that's a pretty dang good switch. Now, about Ford. Ford workers will get a 25% general wage increase plus COLA raises that will put the pay increase to over 30% to above $40 an hour for top scale assembly plant workers by the end of the contract. The overall cost, which still must be ratified by the members, and I hope they're smart enough to do that, is estimated to be $6.2 billion over the 4.5-year deal. Now, Ford is at a 52-week low. I don't know. I think, and again, investors are looking out and say, how are you going to make that work? Ford said the customers in North America are becoming more and more unwilling to pay a premium for electronic vehicles. You're seeing that across the board, not just Ford. Customers' reluctance to pay extra for those kinds of vehicles has complicated Ford's expensive plans to increase production of those things. And while industry sales are growing, they aren't growing at the rate that they had expected. So as a result, Ford's postponing a $12 billion manufacturing investment. And it cost them, the EV unit, cost them $3.1 billion, a loss of $3.1 billion just through the first three quarters of the year. So that'll be interesting. Toyota Motor Chairman Akio Toyota asked about the electronic vehicles, because they haven't really done much. They said that the auto industry should hedge its bets by continuing to invest in hybrid gasoline, electric, and other options beyond just electric vehicles. He said, and I'm quoting, "There are many ways to climb the mountain that is achieving carbon neutrality," unquote. Now, you keep hearing in the news about how this 10-year bond is all over the place, and it's very important, and it is, because the return, the yield, the interest rate on the 10-year treasury influences borrowing costs for a lot of stuff, mortgages, credit cards, vehicles, business loans, all that stuff. And some of the loans are tagged to that rate so that it could float up and down. So that's obviously followed very closely. Now, this right now, currently, the 10-year is on pace for its third consecutive annual drop. Now, we've got data going back to 1928, and it's never happened before, 3 years in a row like this. The worst three-year period was in 78 to 80, when we had a 3% loss for the bond over that three-year period. Now, with the 10-year yesterday at about 4.8%, so far, the cumulative decline from 21 through 23 is now about 26%, a drop of 26%. How the heck did we get there? Once again, bonds, you get the interest, they're guaranteed to pay off, and in my experience, by 99% do. Predictability of income, it could be tax-free. I mean, there's a lot of reasons that bonds need to be considered for part of your portfolio. But they aren't risk-free. That's where a lot of folks get confused. You think you put your money in there and, I need to get out, say, 4 years into a 10-year bond. Well, depending upon where the interest rates are then, will determine whether or not you make or lose money on your original investment. So how'd we get down 26%? Well, interest rates coming up from historic lows has a lot to do with that, because, see, the bond prices, in other words, what your bonds are worth, which is whether they're individual, in an ETF, in a mutual fund, wherever, they're all affected, it's math, they're all affected by in the same manner. And interest rates were historically low at the end of 2020. The 10-year was at just 0.93%, okay? So now it's, 4.8%? On a percentage basis, that's pretty dang big. And last week, when everybody was having a hissy fit about it, it crossed above 5% for the first time since 07. See, bonds, and their price and value are inverse. As interest rates rise, existing bonds that are out there will drop in price, because the new ones have to be, issued relative to whatever the prevailing rates are. And if you're, say, today, you can get a 5% bond, just as, well, like the 10-year, the 4.8% bond, and you've got one of those 3.5% bonds, they're still AAA, they're still paying interest, but by definition, 4.8 is more than 3.5, so that 3.5 is going to drop. Again, nothing wrong with the bond. It's just math. Now, here's the opposite. See, for a long time, it's kind of like interest rates. Folks were inured to the fact that there could be risk in bonds, because all they did was go up in value. In August of 1981, the 10-year treasury was 16.7%. Yeah, 16.7. There's a lot of other stuff going on, too, but just take it for what it's worth. August of 2020, that is, that same bond, not the same bond, but the 10-year bond was at 0.56. So if that inverse relation, cheapers, Mike, inverse ratio works, that means that as the prices dropped, the value went up. Now we're at the other, well, not now, but we've been going up the curve from that, and it just went up a lot here recently. James Grant, who writes, he's the editor and founder of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, which is a highly regarded, that's not a magazine, but a report. He said 5% is more or less the average of investment grade rates, that means good quality rates, since Alexander Hamilton, Now, Al hasn't been around a while, so that's a long time. And the problem is that the 10 years of ultra-easy money that the feds and Congress brought about, it was abnormal. And people thought, well, that is normal. They get used to it. You know, of course, that's the way it always is. And now we're just getting what I think is to the normalization of rates. And that previous bout of abnormal rates where it was nothing is really the problem. See, because the 10-year today is still below, since 1954, what has been their average return of 5.6%. This is not, so we're not hardly out of line. And the average 10-year since 1926 is 4.8%, right exactly where we are right now. So why all the heavy breathing? Because people aren't used to it, so it must be something wrong. You know, yields moving back to where they've mostly been for the last seven decades hardly strikes me as a problem. There's little evidence that stocks can't rise or the economy grow with rates higher than what we saw from 2008 to 2021. I can attest to that. Over my career, I've seen markets have gone up with rates going, you know, much, much higher than what they are now. Matter of fact, Brian Belsky from BMO says, and I'm quoting, rising interest rates have seemingly benefited the U.S. stock market performance. He said, in fact, the S&P has put up an average price return of 13.6% during periods of increasing rates compared to just 6.5% average gain during periods of falling rates. Well, Brian, my boy, I hope that once again comes true. So, we're not getting out of control with these interest rates by any stretch, folks. Please understand what happened recently, you know, from 08 to 21 was unusual, historically low, not normal, and not something you should use as a base of reference. So, enough about that. The GDP, gross domestic product. How did we do? This is our report card on the economy. Now, understand that these kinds of reports are what they call trailing news. In other words, this is all old news. I mean, there's nothing we can do to affect it, change it. This is just what happened in that quarter. So we grew at 4.9%. This is according to the Commerce Department. And that was much stronger than what the economists were anticipating just a few months ago, and up from 2.1 in the second quarter. The core GDP, that includes consumer spending, business fixed investment, home building, while excluding all government purchases, inventories, and international trade, because they're volatile, core GDP was up 3.3% in the third quarter. So that's good. Now, the big reason for the blowout growth, real simple. We all stepped up our spending. You know, we kind of, in the face of what these doom and gloomers said, we pulled back due to a series of interest rate hikes aimed at cooling inflation by slowing the economy. Well, the acceleration, which was suggested by the combination of strong hiring and the retail data, likely won't change the Fed plans to hold, as we said earlier, rates steady at their meeting next week. Now, maintaining the growth into next quarter, that might be a little tougher. But the point is that we did good. And it was far and away stronger than what economists expected when it got underway. Matter of fact, in July, the anticipation was that the GDP would grow by 0.6% in the quarter. Once again, pay no attention to forecasts. Even Jamie Dimon said that about the banks. He said, you guys are all messed up. You can't hit, you couldn't predict anything. I thought that was pretty funny. But one of the things that they got wrong was consumer spending. 4% annual rate is, again, we stepped up purchases of services and especially goods. You know, the wider availability of stuff like cars as supply chains get ironed out helped. And the fact that prices for some goods have actually fallen, well, that probably helped support some spending as well. You know, some people have said that the GDP growth is too hot. What does that mean? Anyhow, they say it leads to more inflation and rate hikes. Others are saying, oh my goodness, the GDP surge will soon cool into a winter chill. You know, neither are happy, but a look under the hood shows that the GDP's main private sector drivers are growing fine, thank you very much. Those arguing the overheating case should find some, I guess, solace beneath the headline of the GDP figure. While Consumer spending 4% was strong. It isn't particularly unusual. The first quarter was 3.8%. That was good. And yet inflation has cooled all year. Furthermore, this inflation uptick in the third quarter came alongside slowing core prices. Now remember, inflation is about money supply, and that's continuing to fall. So you want to track it, you give it some kind of low grade, which way is inflation going, track the money supply data. And for those thinking that the GDP is masking underlying weakness, whether flat biz investment or dwindling savings or whatever, those are long-running fears and well-known and, well, haven't been borne out, quite frankly, in the market. And yes, business investment is often a swing factor for growth, but it goes both ways pretty dang quick. And, you know, and meanwhile, household finances, which is what we are all very interested in, are much better shape than many realize, and that supports further consumer spending. Because the coverage suggests that disposable personal incomes have continued to rise faster than inflation since this January. Debt service and delinquencies are continuing near record lows. That's really nice. And so consumers are hardly tapped out. And I think you can expect both GDP and consumption to cool some from here. But the fear of flipping into a recession, I don't know. I don't feel it. Now, that's worth exactly the words that they came out with, but I don't see it. Now, as another tech, September saw new home sales put up the largest monthly gain since February of 22. That was better than the most optimistic forecast of anybody. And the gain to the upward trend in sales in the past year, which are now 39.8% above the low of July of 22, but still well below 2020. And of course, the main issue is affordability. The good news for potential buyers is that the median sales price of new homes is down about 16% from the peak of late last year. And one more thing, pending home sales, that's contracts on existing homes, rose 1.1% following a 7% drop in August. Very simple. We need more supply to keep it growing. Huh? How about that for a rocket scientist kind of response? Yep. So, on to the market. Over my whole career, which is a while, people have been predicting all kinds of terrible things, like the crash of a dollar, government debt prices, and, of course, the end of times as we know it. Now, in the 80s, as you may recall, Japan was going to overthrow the U.S. as a global power, and then in the 2000s, it's been China. Now, the dollar remains the global reserve currency and has actually strengthened since 08 and 09. And currencies, everybody's, are always and forever cyclical. But some folks were sure the dollar would crash following 08. Sorry, didn't happen. And it would be hard to argue any country survived the pandemic around the world as well as we did. Our economy is actually in a better place than where the International Monetary Fund projected it would be in 2019, before the pandemic. And the rest of the world is worse off, economically speaking. The U.S. currently has the lowest inflation in the G7 as well. So our economy has experienced higher growth and less inflation than the rest of the developed world. Not a bad place to be. Now, during the inflation of the past 40 years, our wages have mostly been keeping pace with prices. In fact, we're back on trend for pre-pandemic levels of wage growth. Let's see. As I just said before, we just had the largest three-year jump in wealth in this country, more than double the next largest increase on record. But to the doomers predicting the end of the U.S. empire, as it were, good luck betting against America. That's always been a losing trade, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. I'm not completely dismissing the idea that other world powers will rise, no. I mean, I just think it's a bit premature to be dancing on our grave just yet, especially as an economic power. And here's a good reason for it. It probably doesn't get much press. Every minute, millions of decisions are made in a country to increase profits. I doubt there are any decisions ever made to reduce profits. This is a huge, constant tsunami of ideas to improve the economy and to make it worth more. This is outside what the Gov, Federal Reserve, China, and the rest of the world does for their own interests that affects our economy. No one ever mentioned this internal, positive, overwhelming, and systemic counterforce to the political influences on the economy. It's really a major difference between capitalism, where risks are rewarded, and controlled economies, but it's really never recognized as the individual strength of our economy. That's my opinion. Jamie Cox, managing partner at Harris Financial Group. You all know Jamie. He had this to say. It's hard to square such sequentially good economic growth as we have with such lackluster stock market performance. There apparently is only one clear explanation. Investors think that the zero interest rate policy is the only condition which permits the economy to grow, and that is clearly an incorrect assumption, unquote. Again, we've seen markets go up with rates significantly higher than where they are now. Matter of fact, in the 80s, we were told that the interest rates could never go below 5 because it just couldn't happen. You tell me why. But, again, when the markets do go down, and those financial pornographer networks are yelling that you should save yourself before you end up living under the bridge with Chris Farley, it feels like a wild animal might be chasing you. So the only thing for you to do is run and dump your stuff because you can run faster, right? Well, feeling scared perhaps is normal at that moment, and the last thing you need is a lecture on the history of long-term stock market returns. Nonetheless, please consider these data points when these goofballs are running around. The market, historically, has been up 55% of all trading days, all. 65% of all trading months, and 75% of all trading years. Would you like a baseball player with a 750 batting average? You might want to sign these guys up. Now, there's an old Wall Street saying, actually, there's a lot of old Wall Street saying, but anyhow, this one says that the stock exchange is the only place where, when there's a big sale, everyone runs away. I've never understood it. I've seen it as long as I've been in the business. Prices go down. They mark them down. I don't want them. When they go up, yeah, give me a bunch of them. You tell me why. Another saying in a similar line is that when the time comes to buy, you won't want to. Matter of fact, a gentleman named Walter Diemer, who's a technical analyst of note, even wrote a book with that title. So is that what this is? You know, everyone knows that the best three-month period of the year begins next week. That's November through January. And that's true. That's when you see the best returns in the market every year. Everyone knows that volatility historically peaks in October. Everyone knows that stocks historically do very well entering an election year. That's all just basic market history. It's all public information, common knowledge. You can look it up. So, when the time comes to buy, do you? Please consider this. In the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ average about 252 trading days a year. So that translates to 20 years is about 5,000 trading days. So between January 1st of 03 and December of 30th of 2022, we looked at the 60 best market days. In other words, of all those, all that time in there, who had the best results of 60 days? And assumed a $10,000 investment in the S&P in 2003. That would have grown, presuming you didn't put your little hands in there, to $64,844, which is 9.8% return. Adjust the numbers accordingly. And that was according to research from J.P. Morgan Asset Management. And those 60 best days were only 1% of the total trading day. And you don't know that until after the fact. Staying the course is always the key. Now, at the last end of the last segment, I was talking about staying the course is the key. I have a chart before me. I hold it up, but I have a face for radio, so I don't get to do this on TV. This goes back to 1802. Now, that's before even some of you were born, through June of 2023. So, long term. Over that entire time, and this is from Stocks for the Long Run by Dr. Jeremy Siegel. A book I would recommend to anybody who wants to learn or know something about the markets. In any regard, over that entire period, the growth of a dollar we had the dollar itself being down 1.4% adjusted for inflation. The next worst return was gold with a 0.6% real return. Yeah, that's why everybody's going there as a flight for safety. That makes no sense whatsoever. Treasury bills, short-term money basically, 2.5% return over that period of time. Corporate bonds, quality bonds, 3.5%. And finally, stocks, 6.8%. Put another way, a dollar in those stocks turned into $2 million. A dollar in the bonds, $1,855. A dollar in gold, $3.92. I don't know. Seems pretty obvious to me, but stick with quality and all of that stuff. Regardless, back to the point at hand. There's a lot of people that like to, say if I'm going to be in the market, I'll just go in the S&P. The S&P 500 index, has ETFs. There's different ways you can participate. But what the S&P 500 is a stock index that tracks the performance of about 500. I think it's like 503 or 4 right now, actually, of the largest publicly listed U.S. companies as measured by market capitalization. In other words, how many shares do they have outstanding times the number of shares equals that number. So the big companies obviously have bigger ones. Now, the top 7 in the index, which I'm sure you could all pull off your memory bank pretty quickly, has provided 70% of the return and 24% of the market cap in the S&P 500. Now, because of its diversification by industry, not type of stock, but by industry, the S&P is a standard performance benchmark for many stocks, mutual funds, ETFs, and especially in the large cap space. Because, see, they're all large cap. They aren't. There's no small cap, there's no mid cap, there's no internet. It's all large cap. So it's not really diversified in the strictest sense of the term. So for that reason, you get a standard deviation, which I don't want to get into that right now because it's a math thing. You can look it up. It's 18.5%, which is, you get a lot of flipping for your money. That's all it amounts to. In other words, whatever the S&P does, that's what your investment is going to do. So, and talking about this cash flow and stuff, since 1926, and again, we have the best records, dividends in the U.S. market have increased annually at 5% a year. And dividends have grown even faster recently, up 5.7% since 1950, 5.9% annually since 1980. As a result, typically your dividends have historically been a pretty dang good inflation hedge as companies have grown. Now, looking at today's environment, let's say you're an income-focused investor who's thinking about locking in the 4.8% current return on 10-year treasuries for the next 10 years. And you're listening to the fear-mongers and, oh my God, I got to be safe. I'm going to protect my money. Sort of. So anyhow, that turns into $4,800 a year for $48,000 in taxable interest payments over the life of the bond. And you for sure get your money back. Always a good thing. Now, it's pretty good. Especially when you consider those tiny bond yields we were talking about. Like I say, the 10-year in July of 21 was 0.59% per year. No meaningful figure, in other words. So the S&P has a current dividend yield. Yes, the S&P does have a dividend, because all those stocks do, of 1.6%. So you'd pick up a fast $1,600 in annual income. Now, that doesn't even come close to matching the bond thing, so why not just put it in the bonds? Well, hold that thought. Income in the stock market doesn't work like bond coupon payments. Dividend payments have tended to rise over time because better earnings in the underlying company and to some extent inflation. So let's assume that the 5% average dividend growth rate remains in effect over the next 10 years. Your dividends would go up from $1,600 to nearly $2,500. In other words, to match that 4.8%, you'd still need price growth of just 2.5% in the stock market over that time. I think we could probably do that. So as a result, your dividends have historically been a great inflation hedge as companies have grown those payouts over time. So it seems to me that over time, stocks have proven themselves to be your best hedge against inflation. If you look at stocks over, let's see, since 1928, the average returns 6.6% for stocks, 1.5% for bonds, and 0.2% for cash. So I don't know how, math to me makes it real easy because there's no hyperbole. It's just, here's the numbers. You can decide on your own if it's straight scoop or not, right? You know, so you say, gosh, how could the S&P be up so much after 50 years of doom, gloom, perdition, wars, pestilence, you pick it? Well, because that's how much the earnings are up, the corporate earnings are up. Great companies, you know, monitor, take care of their shareholders' capital and are constantly looking for ways to grow their earnings despite an endless succession of very real crises. They don't stop doing that just because the market price changes on their shares. You know, and in spite of those crises, what's proven to be one of the most powerful and yet completely effortless way, that's effortless, that was what I was shooting for, effortless way for folks to keep their income growing far ahead of what inflation takes away? The constantly rising cash dividends of the great companies of America and the world. Dividend growth, I think, is one of the most underappreciated things in stock investing. Because people just think, you know, I buy it here and it goes up there, that's the return. No, you get something while you wait. Now, the time to break even, in other words, from a loss, has been even shorter than even the most optimistic investor had any right to expect. I'm talking about of the overall marketplace now. And here's the thing. You know, it's kind of like I said at the top, when you say, you know, the market is like a store, and when everything goes on sale, everybody runs out the door because they don't want to buy it. Human nature has it exactly backward. They can't see that when stock prices are falling, okay, now here's how it works. The value of the underlying companies as ongoing businesses is actually rising. I think the last thing you'd ever want to do is to sell your highest quality core stock investments when their true long-term value is soaring. See, you know, price goes down, value goes up in with quality issues. I'm not saying not across the board, because if you got Dreck is Dreck, right? So that's about it for this week. I believe the Zags are going to be playing here someday soon. I'm looking forward to that rather heavily. Nonetheless, I hope that this has proven helpful to you. The key here is, with these markets, is be careful of your attitude. That's the only thing you can control, right? I mean, you can't control the news. You can't control what some goofy guy is going to say or do anywhere in the world to cause terror and carry on. Just stick with your knitting, as it were. Stay with quality. Do not react to the news headlines. Consider what you're trying to do with your money, for what purpose, or purposes, more correctly. The long term is where you need to be. If you need to have short-term needs, well, you invest for part of it with short-term money and have an emergency fund set aside so you don't have to liquidate good quality things when the market isn't necessarily in your favor. So on that note, we'll be back next week, same bat time, same bat station, and hopefully you'll have a great week. Hopefully the markets will decide to have a great week. We're transitioning into that best time of the year now, middle of the week. We'll be going into November, and hopefully we'll see the growth come with it. Well, thank you very much for listening. I hope you found this to be of interest. My name is Mike Mayle. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and you've been listening to Money Management.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayle. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.